The lounge looks nice. Luckily, we don't have the place.
It's because Mr. Wong, what you're seeing is all the scotch behind me.
I know. I did kind of get lost because you sat right in front of the scotches.
Yeah, it's right over my shoulder.
As if you knew.
As I touched the Lagavulin 8 years.
As if you knew where my heart exactly was.
Yeah, I did actually.
Yeah. Oh, man, don't open that bottle. No, don't do that. No.
I have to take it out with me when I go back out. So.
How am I supposed to focus when you, it's off, when you're holding
it's,
that bottle?
It's off camera. It's off screen.
Okay, good. Thank God. All right. Thank you. Also, shout out to Kim for being the goat.
Oh, yeah, Kim. You're the greatest.
You're seriously the goatest goat ever.
Those of you that don't know, we are talking about our friend and coworker, Kim.
Johnson.
Kim Johnson. Yeah, the fucking goat.
Did you know that over $5 trillion exchanges hands on a daily basis? That's an average of over $220 billion an hour. Now, how does this much money move every single day, and why does it move the way it does? Here on Drunkenomics, two bartenders who also happen to be students at the University of Nebraska Graduate School of Business are going to sit down and drink to the global economy and try and translate it into English. So sit back, relax, pour yourself a stiff one, and have a drink with us to the comedy that is the global economy.
All right, guys, welcome back to Drunkenomics, the drinking podcast with an economics problem. I am once more the less gracious host, James Goldwater, alongside my main man and drinking companion, Aaron Wong.
And the more gracious host. Don't
obviously,
leave that out.
Yeah, okay. Definitely this week, the more gracious host. Yeah. More often, the most gracious
host. I will say this. So the VIX actually crossed above 17 today, and I thought for a second there.
It's touch and go for a while.
Yeah, it touched and went twice at 17. So I thought for a second there, you know, I was watching the VIX all day. And I was like, ooh, I think James might win it this week.
Yeah, it's okay. But we righted the boat. Ship went up.
Yes.
It'll be okay.
So everyone's back in the normal state. Welcome back to this drinking presentation. Or if it's your first time, welcome to this drinking presentation.
Absolutely.
With an economics problem.
All right. And if you want to either bring your economics problems to us or ask us about how to solve an economics problem you may have encountered, why don't you go ahead and track us down on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Drunkenomical.
DRUNKENOMICAL.
Boom. Nailed it. See how gracious he is, folks?
I know,
and then
so gracious.
From there, you can find the invite to a Discord, which, you know, we've had some fun people jumping in this week, and
yeah,
that's where you're going to get. I mean, we're going to interact with you on all of them, we promise, but Discord is where we are the most frequently.
And I will say this, because I had someone on Instagram message me today saying, hey, is your Discord channel free? So
absolutely,
I'll mention it's free. You can come to the Discord channel and bring your economics problem to the altar and lay it down there, and we'll have a drink over it.
There exactly.
We'll break some bread, have some scotch over it. So yeah. With that said, let's dive right into it.
So this week's, there's two things that I'm looking at this week. And the first is that last week, obviously, there was a hurricane. Well, mm-hmm. By the time you hear this, the hurricane will, I think, have been downgraded to just nothing.
Is it still passing or is it still active? Or?
Yeah, it was heading up into the northeast. It was heading up into the northeast at this point. So I think by Thursday, it's supposed to be off the coast of Maine.
Oh, dang. Wow. It's going way up there.
Yeah.
I saw the tracker. I thought it was going out of like Virginia or something like that.
It might be. It may have changed.
It does often shift course. Yeah,
it's kind of funny living in Nebraska and seeing hurricanes and being like that. That's just the Florida mentality of, oh, sweet, better get some beer.
Yeah, exactly. And I did see that. So it's called Hurricane Ida. And seriously, first and foremost, let's just say, prayers for those that are impacted, that have to be relocated or whatever it is because of this hurricane. My deepest sympathies to those people.
Looking at it, it's the depression that was once Hurricane Ida is now sitting right over the middle of Tennessee.
Oh, okay.
So,
I mean, how bad is it now, though? Is it still hurricane status?
It's just a depression. So it's a big chunk of low pressure. So it's a lot of rain.
Okay.
It's a lot of wind, but it's broken up. It's no longer a hurricane. It's not even a tropical storm. It's just really bad weather, really low pressure.
Oh, okay.
But it did come ashore as a Category 4 hurricane. So it really did do a lot of damage.
It was pretty drastic.
Louisiana, New Orleans, Gulf Coast area.
Yeah, and I saw that there's about 1 million people that I think were out of a house. I saw that I think it was 1 million people that are out of house or 1 million people that hopefully it's not 1 million people are still stranded. That'd be really, really bad. And
it wouldn't be good. But
yeah. But it's, I saw something along the lines of 1 million people are either, they don't have a house or they filed an insurance claim or something like that.
Yeah. And that wouldn't shock me. That actually seems kind of low.
I think in terms of that. But like I said, I can't remember what it was. But I also saw another thing that the estimate impact on the U.S. GDP growth this year from just this one hurricane is a negative 0.2%. Which, if you think about it, coming out of a pandemic too, GDP is supposed to accelerate drastically this year coming out of a pandemic. Granted, Delta variant has kind of slowed a lot of things down. A lot of things have slowed a lot of things down, but, a 0.2%, I mean, think about how many billions of dollars that is.
Oh, yeah, it's massive. Well, I mean, think about it this way. So, like, you have In the Gulf of Mexico, you have oil production reduced. They said as much as 91%, which, okay, what does that mean? So that Gulf region produces, I think they said, about 15 to 16% of U.S. total oil. So that means that the U.S.'s oil production with that 91% decrease is between 13.5-14.5%.
Yeah. Well, and so, that's the oil that's off the coast, like in kind of like a deep water horizon kind of deal.
Absolutely.
Like that.
And that, okay, so, and then the next thing is there are four locations of the Strategic Oil Reserve, which is where the U.S. government strategically reserves oil for emergency purposes. And two of those are in Louisiana.
Oh, which is right in the path of the storm.
Yeah, so if you're trying, and that's to say nothing of all the refineries down there. And then the fact that I think the largest liquid natural gas hub in the U.S. is in Louisiana.
Oh, dang,
so if we're looking at this, this is affecting the supply in the short term and in potentially the long term of these goods.
Yeah.
So we're going to see those prices go up.
Yeah, and I think there's an OPEC meeting this week as well.
And then
they're meeting tomorrow. They're meeting tomorrow, September 1st. So today is August 31st as we record. OPEC's meeting tomorrow, and I think they're just going to talk about whether or not. I think the last time they increased they increased oil production by 400,000 barrels per day.
Yep, not a whole lot.
For the next couple. It's pretty much nothing. It's
it's
like if the S&P 500 rose by 3 points. I mean, it's nothing. So yeah, that's pretty much what it was.
My guess is you'd see them turn on some more stuff, like just start pumping at a certain places that there are certain wells that they had probably shut down or really decreased production. They might be starting to try and open them back up. But
I think based on the way markets acted today, or at least the oil markets acted, it looks like they're expecting production to increase.
So this is one of those kind of like short-term, long-term questions in supply.
Yeah.
Short-term with the U.S., you know, with the Gulf and with some other things, we're seeing a short-term oil supply decrease. Long-term oil supply will be absolutely unaffected. So like those rigs that were shut down, it's not like the rigs were destroyed. The rigs were just, they're just not producing.
Yeah. Well,
so to me, that just looks like we might see a spike in oil prices over the next few days, but that's probably it. I don't see it. And then we'll see gas prices probably go up because of that, because you'll see them go, we're 13, 14% decrease in oil supply. So raise the price on gasoline.
Yeah. But, actually, I was wrong. So WTI fell barely on this afternoon, but it went back up at the end of the day. So I was wrong. I was looking at the wrong data earlier, but.
No, I was just saying that in the long run, oil supply is not affected. Nothing's really disrupted. We're just seeing a short-term shock to the oil system, pushing a leftward shock of just less oil for now. But that's only, we're not in the middle of winter. We're not in the middle of a huge demand for it. So it's...
Well, I mean, but to your point, like I think what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to brace for the increasing demand for oil once things start to open back up.
And that's the thing. I think they're going to open their tap a little bit more. I know that everyone else is saying, I think they'll do it just because then it's like, okay, we can... Let's make sure that essentially that our pipeline works, that our production works. It's like that slowly ramping up. It's essentially you've gotten your team back from the off season.
The training
you're starting
camp.
You're going into camp.
Yeah.
So
I hate to bring back a ghost from your memory, but you remember the Colonial Pipeline? They're starting to move oil around now.
I do.
And that's, did you see that?
I did. Yeah. So
think back to our Kevin Adler episode.
Absolutely.
Man.
You know, and that's, so that's a fun, that one's wholly kind of unaffected. It's just, essentially at this point, we just got refineries and oil production through Louisiana is going to be slowed, probably through parts of Mississippi and through that eastern part of Texas.
Right.
So it's a short-term issue and that's about it.
And speaking of which, have we talked about Jackson Hole yet? The Jackson Hole Symposium.
We haven't. That was your thing. I know that I still haven't found the minutes.
Yeah. So we're still waiting on the minutes. I haven't seen very much, but I watched the speech and, you know, it happened so long ago. You know, I've done a lot of drinking since then. And, you know, when I watched it, I was at the gym. So I was like thinking about what I was going to do, like for the workout. Not that I work out very much, but, you know, I was out of breath as I was walking on the treadmill. And yeah, it seems like he's very stuck on this inflation is transitory camp. You know, to me, it's a little bit of a head scratcher because I think what Jerome Powell did was he pointed out all the bottlenecks in the supply chain. And he was like, you know what? Like, remember back then, earlier this year, when everything was super expensive? Well, it's not that expensive anymore. He didn't talk about real estate as much. I mean, he kind of like brushed over from what I remember, and I could be way wrong, but from what I remember, he just
I think
brushed
he has
over
to,
it.
He has to ignore a lot of the real estate stuff because real estate, there's not a whole lot of, with interest rates being so low and with people making buys into, or with essentially investment firms moving into the real estate market the way they historically haven't. We're looking at a shift in what real estate is and how it's being treated. So it's probably like he's taking that and he's going, so much weird stuff is happening here that it's not fair. Let's look at other things where there hasn't been this radical change.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like the most recent real estate data that we saw, I think was June data. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is today. Like I saw this today where it says home prices soared to a record 18.6% in June, right? It's all time highs. And if you look at the graph of, I saw a graph earlier today with like, you know, inflation adjusted real estate prices, and it's flat, flat, flat. You know, there's a few humps here or there, but it's pretty much flat. And if you look at 2021, it's like this steep, steep increase of real estate prices, well, inflation adjusted.
So I think if we look at that, we're seeing that you have these investment firms buying houses now in ways that they historically hadn't, right?
Yeah.
You're seeing a decrease in production of new housing, right? So it's kept steady, but they're not increasing it despite they need to.
Well, because, I mean, the cost of building a house is
it's absolutely up. So you also have those raw material costs.
Inflation everywhere, right?
And then on top of that, you also see this. At one point, I remember seeing in June, maybe early July, that there was a 90% decrease year over year in the availability of single home plots.
Wow.
So just, essentially, there was less land to be developed than by nearly 90% from the year before. So if you've got fewer houses being built on less land for with more expensive goods. Prices are going to go up.
I mean,
combine that with record low interest rates.
And a bunch of my friends at work in real estate, I see them post their videos all the time trying to market themselves as real estate agents, which I think, I support all of them, but they all are speaking the same narrative. You know, whenever I watch their marketing videos, it's, we all know inventories are low.
So that's the big one.
So it's kind of the same deal when there's five bottles of scotch and there's six buyers. Yeah, let's see what happens to the prices of those bottles of scotch.
You either need to be there first before they know there's six buyers, or you need to be there with the deepest pockets, or at least deeper pockets than the sixth guy.
Yeah, and that's the only way you can really come home with that bottle of scotch. Same with real estate prices. And also, like, you know, I think Jerome Powell, he's citing all these things. Like he talked about how lumber prices were going down, used car prices were going down. Pretty much everything that, like, if you're staying in the inflation is transitory side of the fence, I mean, he's spitting all the evidence out that supports that, which he's not wrong. Like, he's
definitely right. Like, if you take that evidence, I think he's looking at it and he's going, this confirms that this is inflation or this is a transitory. But he did couch the one statement because he said central banks cannot count on it being transitory.
Yeah. And I think financial institutions are also not counting on it being transitory. I mean, we're talking about loan deposit ratio being 54%. Why? I also think a lot of that is kind of, you know, I don't want to loan my money out because
Low interest rates, high inflation.
Yeah.
I might lose money on this.
I mean, but a lot of banks are also kind of bracing themselves for long-term inflation, right? So long-term inflation worries, then that's when you're like, okay, you know, I don't really want to loan that much money out right now because, you know, when I get paid back in 5 years, it's not going to outpace inflation and interest.
Exactly.
So why would I do that? Why don't I just invest it myself?
Well, it doesn't hurt that these banks are also sitting there. And like we talked about the other day, you know, you've got a central bank or a government giving them money and saying, loan this out. But at the same time, bank regulators sitting there going like, hey, you know how you didn't loan this money out to all these different people? Good job. You know, like, great work.
You see all these risky loans? Good job not sending out those loans, right? So that's exactly what's going on. I mean, it's, you know, it's like you said last week, the right hand, left hand thing.
You know, it's kind of all I can think of is, you know, the movie Dr. Strangelove?
Oh, yeah.
So Peter Sellers is sitting there and he's got the one hand that's trying to kill him and the other hand trying to stop. That's just kind of what I feel like, unfortunately, is happening in this case.
Yeah, he keeps saluting. Mm-hmm. He keeps hitting his hand. He's like, yeah. And the last thing I saw from, I think, one of the most important things that stuck out to me, granted, I don't remember very much of this meeting, so I apologize for being very forgetful. But regardless, I saw that Jerome Powell really wants to keep inflation at around 2%. And he says that he has the tools and the resources available to do so, which I'm not quite sure is good news or bad news. I'll let you be the judge.
Man,
is that not kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, when we see inflation start nearing 2%, then we'll start deploying our resources that will keep it at a steady 2% inflationary target.
He's got the tools. I don't disagree with him, but
he definitely does.
The problem is that 2% mark might be artificially. It's put this way: 2% is artificially low.
It really is. I mean, normally it's 3%, or like at least historical averages.
The U.S. it's been. You can get 4 or 5%. And I would say, like, as long as productivity is exceeding that, that's not terrible. But this idea of 2% seems to suggest that there's an expectation that productivity of the American worker or the American productivity is going to be less than it's been historically. And there's probably some truth to that, but it's also it's a very concerning concept right there.
Yeah, but I think what's also concerning too is that, like, you know, the Federal Reserve can literally be like, oh, inflation is rising. It's at like 1.8% right now. Oh my God, it's at 1.9. Now it's at 1.98. Like, now let's start lifting interest rates to keep it at a steady 2%. A slowdown of velocity of money, just keep it at 2%,
if you could do it at 2%, but you could find a way to infuse money into, if it was me and I was running the Federal Reserve, I would be more concerned with getting money to people when I'm trying to control an economy. I'd be trying to get my money to people with a low propensity to save. So I want people that are going to spend their money. But, and that's how I'm going to stimulate and slow the economy.
If everybody's spending, you're not really slowing the economy.
No, if everyone's spending, that's what I'm saying. Like, so, but what I'm saying is you're trying to control how money gets there. Because that's where the velocity is. If you give money to people that the propensity to save, they sit on it. They invest it.
Yeah,
so if you give it to people with propensity to save, then you're not going to speed your economy up. But you're also really probably not going to slow it all down. Your real problem is if you start.
There's still a lot of M1, M2 money supply, which both things.
Just, I think it's just kind of in the wrong place, but that's me. I'm excited for the minutes. I want to see the Jackson Hole minutes so I can really read through what they were talking about. I think the FOMC meeting from last week, 2 weeks ago, the minutes that came out from that, those are a little more indicative of the thought process than the public statement. Because the public statement is intended for the audience. The minutes are like the actual meeting.
Yeah, like what was actually said.
What they're thinking and how they're thinking versus what they're trying to convey to people.
I mean, if you listen to the actual speech that Jerome Powell gave at the meeting, you'd be sitting there going like, this is not English. Like, this, nobody talks like this. If I went up to the bar and started talking to you the way Jerome Powell spoke at the podium, I mean, man, I can't even, I don't have a good quote for you, but
I'd look at you like Bobcat Goldthwait.
Yeah, it's like, we still strongly believe, or we have reason to believe, that global disinflationary forces still remain steady. And it's like, okay, so what does that mean in English? You know what I mean? We don't think there's going to be much inflation around the world. Dude, that's, you could just say it like that, right?
The interesting point is, so they make these statements in the speech, and then the minutes are more of like the why. So his talk is what, and then the minutes are why. And it's like, so their whys make sense.
During his talk, like, he'll actually break it down and he actually talks about like, hey, we're seeing more and more people come back to work, which means more and more production of this and this and this, which leads to the decrease in prices of all of those things. And because of that, we have reason to believe that global disinflationary forces still remain steady. It's just stuff like that. So obviously, I don't speak the kind of English that our main man Jerome Powell speaks. So
it's a very different language to a very different audience. That way.
But some market news. Just want to breeze over this really, really quickly. Yeah. SPRT seems like it's the latest meme stock. This is a stock that exchanged hands. I think the volume was 74 million, and the shares outstanding was about 24 million. So it exchanged hands almost three times in one day yesterday.
Yeah, that's a lot of interest. And so, I don't quite.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Let's see. Let's watch.
And I think any more, like, so how would you define a meme stock? A stock that's up 500% on no news?
Yeah.
Would you define it based on volume?
I would say a meme stock is something that's being traded up by retail investors with little, if any, financial or economic reason to be trading up.
Yeah.
It's essentially a democratic and disorganized pump and dump, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Well, it's like, let's look at it this way too. So I'm looking at SPRT's volume stats from today. Today's Tuesday, August 31st. Volume today was 29 million shares. And guess what? Right next to it on TD Ameritrade, it says, you know, there's volume and it always says heavy, light, normal, whatever. So 29 million shares exchanged hands today. And then under parentheses, it says light. you know, and how do you compare it, whether it's light or heavy? They compare it to the previous 10-day, the trailing 10-day average volume. So the trailing 10-day average volume was 53.2 million. The shares outstanding is 24.2 million. So the trailing 10-day volume for this stock is more than twice as much as, you know, the entire company exchanges hands twice in one day, every, you know, in the last trailing days.
That's a little high.
I would say so too. I mean, that's not normal. Companies shouldn't exchange hands twice. I mean, think about it. If Apple exchanged hands twice in one day, granted, that would take an insane, that would take $4 trillion to
do.
Well,
yeah, but it also, but what that tells me is that there's, if not turmoil, it just tells me that you've got sellers willing to sell with the expectation that this is maybe the terminal value for, okay, I've made as much money off of this as I think I'm going to. I think it's now overpriced and overvalued, so I don't see it going higher. I'll sell.
Yeah, well, and that's why you should sell. But
yeah, absolutely.
And why should you buy? Because you think that the company is undervalued,
yeah,
based on its future cash flows or based on its future potential capital appreciation.
Yeah. So you've got people who are willing to buy because they think that there's an upside.
Yeah.
And you've got people who are willing to sell because they think, well, we've exhausted the upside. So it's, you've got two very different schools or people, groups of people, unless you've got people who are just buying, going, I'm going to buy here and I'll sell what I made, a dollar a share. And then suddenly they do, and then they see it going up more and more and they go, oh, I'll buy back in and I'll do it again. And then you just get a feedback loop.
Yeah. But I don't necessarily know if that's the case. And granted, like, generally speaking, I think, you know, and I'm not like a huge expert on this, but I think the reason why this company has a trailing 10-day average volume of, you know, of two times the amount of shares outstanding, of mm-hmm. actually over two times the shares outstanding, is the short interest is so high. And when you, usually when you short a stock, you're borrowing from someone that's already long the stock, and you're opening short, which leads to another open long position generally. So now you have two long positions and a short position.
Yeah. So you've got people arguing over the same share, and they each claim to have a right to it. But the real person, the only person who really worries about it, is the person who owns it at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Not the guys borrowing it.
Yeah.
But
so that's a pretty funny thing. Robinhood has kind of slumped a little bit.
Well, football season.
Yeah. So I guess to counter that, DraftKings and Penn have been doing pretty well.
But they're countering Robinhood, right? So if Robinhood does well, you'd expect those guys to do kind of poorly. But if they're doing well and Robinhood's doing poorly, then you'd say, well, people are willing to gamble on games, not on stocks.
Yeah. And if you really think about it, I think both of those platforms are gaming platforms, right?
Yeah. You know, just what are you gaming?
Yeah. It just depends on, you know, are you gaming on stocks and options and crypto, or are you gaming on, you know, who's going to win Rookie of the Year this year? In the NFL, I don't think it's going to be Trevor Lawrence.
Not like
a terrible team.
Yeah, no, that one. I also liked, because PayPal, they're thinking about starting a trading platform.
Yeah, so I saw that.
To compete with Robinhood?
I don't necessarily know if they're competing directly with Robinhood.
Well,
but
I would assume all stock trading platforms are competitive with each other in some sense.
Yeah, well, and I think, let's just say this, like I do appreciate Robinhood for everything that they've done. You know, I don't think they're necessarily a great company, but I do appreciate what they've done to investing and trading. They have democratized it. They have made it accessible. They have made it popular and cool and relatively easy, but they have gamified it a lot. So it's kind of like a give and take, you know what I mean? But yeah, PayPal, apparently they're thinking about offering that. Their stock shot through the roof when that happened. They hired a guy named Rich Hagen, mm-hmm. who's a former CEO of a company called and founder. I forgot to mention, he's a founder of a company called Trade King, which ended up being sold to Ally Invest. So he knows a lot about fintech and trading algorithms and things like that. And they brought him on.
So it'll be interesting to see what PayPal does with that. Because they were also, was it PayPal or who was it that was saying they were going to start a crypto platform as well?
So PayPal flirted with the idea of
allowing you to have a digital wallet.
So like, you know, like when you buy concert tickets through Ticketmaster, which Ticketmaster is the worst company in the entire world. I hate buying concert tickets because it's not just Ticketmaster, it's everything, everybody. But anyways, I digress.
Oh, I spent $35 on tickets. I'm spending $25 on a convenience fee. Fine. No, I'll pick them up on the day. Oh, you can't. What convenience is this then?
Yeah, seriously.
The only option.
I know. And then you try to go to the venue website, which is normally what I try to do when I buy concert tickets, is I try to go straight to the venue website. And then they always route me to Ticketmaster, which that's the reason why I'm on your website is because I'm trying to avoid Ticketmaster.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with Ticketmaster, and I can't be bothered to come down to your box office. And when I do show up at your box office, it's closed.
And not to mention, a lot of times it's like, no, you have to go through Ticketmaster. I'm trying to give you money directly. I'm trying to cut out the middleman.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with
make
him.
This transaction more profitable for you.
You know what? So if there's going to be a horizontal, and I think there actually was a while ago, but a horizontal monopoly investigation, we should look into Ticketmaster.
Well, it's Ticketmaster, but all the other companies that do the same thing.
All I can't get into it.
It's like events.com. Yep. I forget what else. Is it events.com? I forget, but I bought tickets to someone else too.
At one point, they were convenient. So, they are no longer creating efficiency. They are now pricing people out of the market.
No, I demand you to recant that statement. They were never convenient.
They were at one point initially, they were when they first gave you the ability to buy.
So for
tickets.
4 minutes, they were convenient.
Exactly.
And, ever since then, they have not been convenient. Okay, I will accept that. But yes, they suck. Anyways, long way of me saying, whenever you go pay for tickets like that or whatever through Ticketmaster, there's like a thing that you can use. You can like pay through PayPal, right? And at one point, PayPal was flirting with the idea of like letting crypto be accessible through that form of payment. And I don't necessarily know what the markup of Bitcoin would be in that sense.
Substantial. That's all I'll say.
Obviously,
because that's substantial.
They have to price in some volatility with that, transfer of payment. You know, it's not like the dollar, right? So, if this dollar could be worth 50 cents tomorrow, then you're going to try to find a way to hedge against that and you're going to charge me $1.25 or something like that, or whatever it is. So, yeah, they flirt with the idea of that. I think, they're one of those companies they're really trying to stay ahead of the curve. I respect PayPal for that. I'm not saying it's a good stock to buy. This is not financial advice. We don't give financial advice, but yeah, mm-hmm. I just thought that was pretty interesting because
it's like to watch. I'd look at it and if you make the decision yourself, you'd have to do that. But I would say this is something new.
Yeah.
This could be, on one hand, it could be Google. On the other hand, it could be like Google Glasses. Like,
exactly.
Could have huge legs or it could have no legs at all.
Yeah. So, it's just one of those things. I just like watching this game theory stuff in real life. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, a prime example of game theory in real life. Lastly, I just want to say this. The S&P, today is the last day of August, the last trading day of August as well, because today is a Tuesday. And the S&P posted 7 straight winning months. Wow. I feel like it's been a long time since that's
weird,
happened.
Right?
Yeah. Nothing is back to pre-pandemic levels, really, except for prices of certain things.
Except for prices and equity and asset value.
I mean, no, those have surpassed. Asset value has surpassed. Real estate has surpassed pre-pandemic levels. But if you look at like unemployment, consumer sentiment, things like that. Oh, and that's another thing that Jerome Powell talked about was he thinks consumer and retail sentiment is pretty strong. Which is why
we'll see.
Yeah.
I'm not so convinced of that myself.
Yeah, but that was one of the reasons why he thinks inflation is still somewhat transitory. But anyways, pretty much nothing is back to pre-pandemic levels, such as retail consumer sentiment, CPI, PPI. It's still relatively high.
Oh, dude, for me, the best news today was obviously the start of the new case.
Oh, with the whole Elizabeth Holmes thing?
Yeah, Elizabeth Holmes is finally in court. I do not like her.
Yeah, I don't like her either.
And no one should. The whole Theranos thing was, I think there was a point for a very little while where it was a legitimate startup, a legitimate tech firm, medical firm. They were trying to do something incredible. And obviously, I'm going to be watching this trial. I'm watching this trial with bated breath because I can't wait to find out when they decide that it stopped being that and it became a criminal entity, when it became a fraud.
I mean, what case does she have? Like, she's facing 20 years. I know, but I'm just saying, what kind of defense is she trying to plead? I mean, what's her case?
She's going to claim that she wasn't defrauding investors and patients. I think she's going to argue that their stuff was, she's probably going to argue that their tech worked and that everything was fine and real and that nothing was fake or that she didn't know.
Yeah.
But,
or she was like, I actually thought, we did some trials and it seemed positive.
Yeah, she'll claim, I thought it was real. I thought, she's going to claim the people below her were lying to her. The problem is, too many people told her and she fired them. So it's very much it's not particularly believable.
Yeah, she literally fired everybody that was saying like, no, this is not, there's nothing here, right? There's no product. So, they got Walgreens to partner up with them. Walgreens, surprisingly,
huge amounts of money.
Yeah, they dropped out of the S&P 500 about 4 years ago, maybe, mm-hmm. I think. I forget exactly, but they dropped out of the S&P 500 because of their investment in Theranos, their partners. They wanted to get ahead and partner up with them. And I just, they didn't do their due diligence and they kind of got suckered into this deal and it didn't turn out to be very good for them. So tough break for Walgreens, but their stock went up 4.5% today-ish. Not necessarily because of this, but more so just because one of two things. I think Walgreens agreed to lift minimum wages to $15 an hour. But I think more importantly, they also reached an agreement with US World Meds for some sort of pharmaceutical distribution or something
I think,
like that?
Yeah, we're going to see an economy of scale coming to pharmaceuticals with Walgreens. So Walgreens can either lower prices or can keep prices the same, but have a better margin on them. So that's I think you're absolutely right. I think that's probably the decision that Walgreens is looking at, and people are looking at going, this is great for Walgreens if I own it.
Yeah.
I think Walgreens is in for kind of a roller coaster, because in this trial, it's going to come out that Walgreens didn't do any due diligence. They were approached by Theranos and they said, you know what? We're in. In fact, it gets even worse, because when Walgreens did try to do a little bit of due diligence, they sent a lab guy to go and watch the Theranos labs and see how it worked and how it was going. And he went and he started telling, he would sit in the Theranos meetings and he was like, well, why aren't you guys doing this, 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 or this? And he reported back to Walgreens, they're not doing this, 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 or this. And then Theranos kicked him out of all the meetings because they didn't want him there. He was being a Debbie Downer. And then, and then Walgreens fired him because Walgreens thought he was jeopardizing the partnership. And it's just kind of those things. It's like, he was telling you you're in bed with
potentially fraudster.
He was warning you that there were some very serious problems with your partner. And instead of investigating those or asking for them to just refute him, Walgreens just went, we believe them before you. And they got rid of him.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just saw that today they picked the jury for this trial, and that was it. The trial got postponed to now from earlier this year because Elizabeth Holmes had a baby. So, yeah. Elizabeth Holmes, who was once apparently America's entrepreneurial darling, you know, she was a very successful female entrepreneur.
She met Clinton, Obama.
Oh, yeah. You know, she was on Forbes 30 under 30, I think.
Yeah, she was.
And Forbes 40 under 40.
For a hot minute, she was a billionaire.
Yeah, she was. She was hanging out with Jack Ma and a bunch of other people. Like, I mean, she was hanging out with other billionaires because she was a billionaire.
She was.
It's kind of the same deal as Trevor Milton, you know. Mm-hmm. He was flying around private jets about a year ago, and now he's
alas, no more.
Yeah, now he just recently had to pay $100 million for a bond. But yeah, that's pretty much the market update.
Yep.
I guess let's just go right into short-term and long-term supply. And this is something I don't know very much about, so I'm going to grill you.
It's a good week for it because we've got, on the one hand, we've got the short and long-term supply of housing. We've also got the short versus long-term supply of oil, which we were talking about a little bit earlier. And I think so we talk about the difference between short and long-term, generally is when we start to think of short and long-term is different for every product. Houses, the short versus long-term, there's a pretty substantial time commitment to that. There's in agriculture, in raw materials extraction of any kind. So oil, metal, even I guess the agricultural products, even livestock, short versus long-term is measured in months, if not years. Whereas short and long-term in a restaurant or a store might be measured in days.
So what do you mean by that?
So when I was talking about oil and I said the short term oil production in the US is going to be down 13-15%, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
That's in the short term. In the long term, it's unaffected.
Of course, yeah. But short term, but how far does short term go out? A year?
Well, that's the big question. So with the Gulf of Mexico production, what I imagine the oil companies would do is they're going to have crews fly out to their oil rigs, check them over to make sure that they're still in one piece, that everything's still functional correctly. And then they'll start pumping again. They'll bring that 15% back up. So the short term for them might be a week. You know, it might be a short term issue. Whereas if they get out there and suddenly they discover every single oil platform is damaged and needs to be repaired, well, that's when this thing that was short term or probably was short term becomes long term. Because now it might be 6, 7, 8 months before they have them repaired and pumping again. So
I mean, but what's the threshold? When does it become short term to long term? If it's down for 2 months, is it long term or is it still short term?
Well, in accounting, we would say anything that takes longer than a year is long term. Economically, when we look at these, there's no real definition of that short to long term break. What we could say is in the short term, we have this. In the long term, it wouldn't be an issue. So in the long term, it's this idea that it's a tenuous idea that there is no time limit on. The analogy I've always liked to use is you're at the bar and there's only one bottle of
Yinglings.
There's only one bottle, or there's only one case. There's one keg of Yingling at the bar.
Okay.
There's a short term problem when they're running low on Yingling. They have a short term supply shortage. I only have as much Yingling as I have here for tonight. Long term,
hopefully, will last me the whole night. But yeah,
hopefully, long term, the truck shows up tomorrow. There is not a long term supply shortage of Yingling. There's a short term supply shortage. I don't have enough to get through the day.
Yeah.
It's so when does that become a long term problem? It becomes a long term problem when the Yingling brewery burns down.
Don't even paint that picture, man.
Okay. There's two. There's one in Florida. There's one in Tampa now. It's everything's okay.
Oh, that's right. There is one in Tampa.
And they've remember they've licensed with Coors, and they've licensed with Coors to produce their product on the West Coast. So it's going to be all right.
Yeah, but that'll still, I mean, if one of them burns down, that'll still make the price of Yinglings spike like crazy.
It would go up.
Yeah, so that's what I said, don't even pay that picture. That's
so
terrible.
The real thing that happens with short term versus long term is that as the short term, so we know that based on basic laws of supply and basic laws of demand, the law of supply is the more expensive the good is, the more of it I'm likely to make, right? So the more I can charge for it, the more I'm going
to
produce.
That's why it keeps balancing back to that equilibrium. So there's supply keeps meeting demand. Unless you're in that school of thought where you think demand meets supply. I don't think so.
Supply meets demand at equilibrium, price at equilibrium, quantity.
Okay, yeah. That's what I think too.
I agree.
But it just depends what school of thought you
decide. Yeah, whether you're a supply or demand side guy.
Yeah, so I think I'm with you. I think supply meets demand at equilibrium because, you know, it's like, oh my God, if I can make $7 a bottle from producing Yinglings, I'm going to produce as much of this as I can.
Yeah.
And not to mention, like, you know, prices of all beer are going to go up just because it's like, you know, there's not... A lot of people are going to be like, it costs $7 to buy a bottle of Yingling. Yes, screw that. I'll just buy Shiner Bock.
Exactly.
You know, so eventually it'll just kind of move it towards that equilibrium across all beers.
Now, what eventually happens is when you have a short-term supply shortage or a short-term issue, what eventually will happen is you'll see the economy will say, well, we have to start producing more of whatever this is. So the long-term, in the short-term, there's a shortage because and prices are very high. But then you have the long-term, which is to say someone says, well, I'm going to build, or if you're Yingling, I'm going to buy a brewery in Tampa because I've had a short-term issue with my ability to produce supply. The long-term issue is I'm going to reinvest capital, improve my production. And then when that happens, suddenly you see this shock. There's a huge increase to supply.
Yeah.
And so that creates the change. That's where we make the, so essentially for me, the difference between a short and long-term supply issue is in the long-term with most things, you can always reinvest and produce more of it so that you eliminate the problem.
But I think eventually when it comes to long-term anything, I think long-term always comes back to some sort of equilibrium, whether like, you know, if you want to pick a specific date way down the road in the future. Yeah. I mean, who knows at that day, but like just long-term in general, just like in a secular viewpoint.
So it kind of depends on like, it would depend on like the goods. So if you're dealing with like fruit, you know, short term issue might be like a season, like, right. So like 1 year might be the short term because all your cherries died in the freeze or there was a drought.
Yeah.
Long term might be 7, 8, 9 years because you have to go out, plant the trees, grow them. And you can expect like, you know, we won't be able to harvest from these for 5 or 6 years. Once we put them in the ground, it'll take us 2 years to put them in the ground. So then you can say, well, the long term is 7, but the short term is the next, is everything after 7 is long term, but every the next 7 years is going to be the short term. So you might say there's like, a short term issue, but we're planting more trees. So in the long term, the issue won't exist.
Yeah, but it takes time. Like if I'm, you know, whether it's like, oh, we can't produce enough grapes and now wine production just can't meet its whatever it is, right? So all of a sudden it's like, well, it's going to take us time to replant those trees. Or if a mine collapses, it's going to take some time to, you know, kind of, you know, move the rubble out of the way and then, you know, reaccess the parts of the mine that you used to be able to access and to extract whatever metal that you were extracting from that area.
Well, so like with houses too, like we have a short term, like right now there's a short term issue with housing in this country. There isn't enough. The long term, the argument would be, well, because it's profitable to build houses, more people will build houses or more developers will develop and build more homes and more communities.
Yeah. But like we mentioned earlier, the problem is lumber costs so much money. Labor costs so much money.
Exactly.
Concrete, cement, everything you need. Granite faux granite, like pretty much everything you need to build a house is insanely expensive. Porcelain, whatever it is.
Well, I would say the real issue is that there's only a finite amount of land. So in the long term,
but
it's like when we talk about things like long term.
Yeah, but there's still so much land. I mean,
there's still a huge amount to be developed.
Yeah, but also the problem is like, okay, how's plumbing going to work in that area? How's sewage, irrigation, and all that kind of stuff? You know, how are you going to access that whole plot of land that you're developing into, not to mention electricity, power? You know, now we have an energy issue at hand as well. You know, how to get these people to make sure that their lights can turn on when they flip that switch up.
But those are real long-term issues.
Yeah.
Really outside the lifespan of a person.
Yeah, exactly. Like super, super long-term. I don't think it's something that you and I are going to have to worry about, but like your kids maybe have to worry about it.
Well, I mean, eventually the sun
they can't even drink
to expand
yet, so.
And the earth is incinerated. So really, if we want to think about it, that's on a billion years.
That's our long-term supply issue.
That's a real
long-term supply issue.
Absolutely.
Because at that point, like how are we going to produce more scotch?
At that point, we have So, but we won't because Scotland won't be there.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so I hate to say it, but there is a...
I don't know how that could ever happen.
Scotch is a finite life. Eventually, there will be no more scotch.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I think the world is going to end eventually.
Unless someone starts a planet called New Scotland, and then...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's going to end the way you think it's going to end, but then again, you know, I was raised differently, but...
That's true.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Still, nonetheless, I mean, a big long-term supply issue at hand here, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I want scotch to be infinite.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know? Everything is finite.
Yeah.
But that's what I meant when I was talking, like, the difference between long-term and short-term. So short-term would be like, as I said, like you're at the grocery store and it's like, oh, we're out of apples. Okay, there's a short-term supply issue. When will you have apples again? Well, tomorrow when the truck gets here. Versus like, no, apples are gone. All the trees are dead. You know, there's only one apple tree left.
Oh,
we have a long-term issue.
Okay, well, that's a pretty cool breakdown. You know, I think it ties in pretty well with the Hurricane Ida thing where it's like,
okay, exactly.
Well, oil production's down. Well, what are we going to do? Well, we've got to figure out when these oil rigs are going to be operable.
So if they're operable tomorrow, it's a short-term issue, if it's an issue at all. If they're inoperable, we may have a long-term issue on our hands, especially if OPEC cuts production.
They're not going to.
No, absolutely.
I mean,
I don't think they will.
There's
either.
No way. This is the dumbest thing from – I mean, not the dumbest thing. I mean, but it'd be dumb. It'd be a dumb move, I think. But then again, I don't know anything about OPEC. I don't know who makes the decisions there, and I don't really understand the motives behind their decisions. Regardless, I think it'd be a dumb move. I think it also ties in well with, I guess, labor.
There's the short-term labor issues and there's the long-term labor issues. Your short-term labor issue is that you may not have people willing to work at the price set now. The long-term labor issue is there are only 7 billion people on this planet. You know, the short-term labor issue might be that I can't get enough workers, from working my factory for $9 an hour. But the long-term issue would be there's only 290,000 people in Lincoln, right? So, or wherever you are.
Or whatever city it is.
It's the short-term is I can't find enough for now. The long-term is
it's
a finite supply.
Yeah, but it's also like that's, you know, all of a sudden a factory goes, hey, I'm going to lift wages to $20 an hour. And now everybody wants to work there. Now, you know, other factors around them are like, why is our entire workforce trying to leave and go to this place? It's like, well, they raise their wages.
So then you follow suit and raise your wages. And then the problem becomes eventually there's just no one else to hire.
Yeah.
So that's the long term.
Or, you know, people are going to be willing to work for less because it's like, you know what? I know you said the base wage is $20 an hour. Well, I need a job. I'll be willing to work for $19.50 an hour. I don't know ever going to happen in the world, but it could.
I mean, I would never show up at a position that was offering me $20 and say, well, I'll do it for less.
No, but I'm sure there are, you know, desperate times, desperate measures.
I'm
sure it's happened before.
Now that's when the supply of labor exceeds the demand of jobs. Yeah, of course that's what happens. When the demand for labor exceeds the supply of labor, that's where this is.
Yeah, and then boom, we have our long-term equilibrium, which is, I think, what it really comes down to.
Which is somewhere in between the two.
Yeah. So I think this is a good stopping point. I know
I
you got to get back to work.
Yep.
I'm all done with my ear.
Huh.
Ears, plural. Yeah, that's really weird. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is I have filled and killed.
I have also filled and killed.
Real quick, before we tie a bow and everything, let's talk about merch. shop.spreadshirt.com/drunken. Oh, wait. What's the new link?
It is drunkenomics.myspreadshirt.com.
That's the one.
I know.
Yes.
It's the other one. So long.
drunkenomics.myspreadshop.com. Weird. I know. But full merch there if you want to let everyone know that you are an econoholic.
Or a
drinkologist.
A drinkonomist.
Drinkonomist. That's the one. Okay. So two schools of thoughts with the drunkenomics camp. You're a drinkonomist or an econoholic. Whichever one you are, whichever one you want people to know that you are, you can go advertise that by getting yourself a shirt at drunkenomics.myspreadshop.com.
We promise we'll have stuff out for both of those soon.
And from there, you can also, if you really just want to just be generous for some reason,
you can head to Patreon and you can help us keep the lights on, liquor cabinet full, and the ice solid.
And the fridge cold, because, you know, that's where I store my beer.
Absolutely.
And last but not least, on Discord, we're going to maybe do Q&A here pretty soon in October because we've had that request.
Had that request a few times. We're going to try and figure out how we're going to do it. We'll get back to you guys.
Yeah, so if that's something that you're interested in, listen to the beginning of the episode again. And, you know, or you could just shoot us a message on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever it is. And we'll send you the link to our Discord.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I guess with that said, Hope you guys continue to play Chestnut Checkers. Don't brag, just say. And most importantly,
we gotta keep it drunkenomical. You gotta stay drunkenomical, guys.
Oh yeah, that's right. Cheers, my friend.
Cheers.
2 weeks in a row, I haven't broken a glass yet. Thank God.
A Huda Media Production.